battle's scarred and getting long in the tooth. Desperate and hungry and got nothing to lose. Yeah, I'm alone. I've been chased, I've been bit. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. They like to shoot at me, but they miss. Yeah, I'm alone. Never been trapped, and God help the people that think they've got me cornered at last. I've been hunting, I've been tracking, I've been running since I was. Born in Louisiana swamp, moved with the pack to Tennessee. Raised by black and white dogs to some country, some rock and roll. They said, now boy, you gonna have to quit your howling soul. Staying up all night and chasing lasses by the moon. All day on the porch playing guitar tunes. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf, and I no longer run with the pack. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf, I don't ever look back. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf out here on the prowl, and most of us.
Preamplifier here. Yeah. Lone Wolf.
Oh, that's too much. There you go. Okay, here we are. Terrible Tommy here. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the Robert J. Matthews Memorial Bunker in North Central Indiana, where they're putting Roundup all around me and Monsanto's poisoning the hell out of everybody. So, hey, they got a new corn worm now that actually has evolved into a situation where it thrives on the poison that was meant to get rid of it. Oh, that's not going to be too good for those corn farmers, I'll tell you that. And as usual, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, right here in the heartland, right here in the part of the Bible Belt. I'll tell you, it seems like it's a buckle of the Bible Belt. When you turn on the radio around here, that's all you hear is, and tell me about the Old Testament, preaching right out of the Torah, right out of Judaism. Most of these preachers spend most of their time, sometimes all our time, on the Old Testament, which is nothing but pure Jewish propaganda and Jewish nationalism. It's being preached and taught on every corner around here. You go about half mile and there's another church, and another half mile is another church. You go another half mile, there's two more churches. These are called mind control centers, or that's what I call them, mind control centers. And you got to hand it to them. They're organized. They got plenty of money behind them because they're wiggling around to where they don't have to pay taxes. And these churches around here look like these giant edifices and cost tremendous amounts of money, while the people around that live close to those churches probably don't even have a job. Well, I see a couple of Texas tycoons here. Sam and Charles Wiley, I guess they were pretty wily, employed a labyrinthine system of offshore trusts to conceal stock trades in four companies on whose boards they sat, netting themselves more than $550 million in undisclosed profits, a U.S. government lawyer told a federal jury on Thursday. You know, I just can't understand someone, never been able to understand the concept of why you need $550 million. I most of my life I've said I don't understand why you need $1 million. I guess I got wired wrong when I was a kid or something. Because I'm wired to say, if you got enough money to get you along pretty good, have a few laughs and so forth, well, don't worry about it. And don't worry about living in a great big old house and all that and driving a brand new car. Don't worry about it. These people go to bed every night, first place, worrying they'd get caught, which they did get caught. Most of them don't get caught. Second place, they're worrying about how to keep it, how to spend it, and who's trying to get it away from them. This virus of greed, you know, I could sort of understand it, but I still do not quite understand it. I sent you out a bunch of pictures of cars you've never seen before. That's compliments from one of our associate wolves out there. I'm telling you, I thought I'd seen about every car there was, but most of these cars I sure never seen even a picture of. Some really classy cars. Unbelievable. I wish they'd have put the name and the manufacturer of the car on a little sign, because been nice to know, but boy, beautiful. You know, I forgot to mention on the 4th was the day that either James Earl Ray got everything he wanted, or the CIA got everything they wanted, or both of them got what they wanted, because that was the day that they put old Martin Luther, you thought I was going to say coon, the Martin Luther nigger away, and he's gone. He's gone. They can name all the streets in the world after him. They don't bring him back. Yep, they can make phony movies about him. I won't bring him back, like they just made one of Cesar Chavez, the little mestizo out there who started out as nothing but a pool hall hustler in Delano, California. I knew all about him. He was an adversary, and the people that joined his union, I guess, were being taken care of pretty well, but there was a hell of a lot of people that didn't join the union, and they were starving to death, and Chavez's goon squad was pushing them around. So John Steinbacher wrote a book called Bitter Harvest. I knew him personally, and he used to speak to the John Birch Society, and we loaded up truckloads of food and transported it up to Delano to feed the people that were starving to death up there. That was really before I was very racial. But I still sympathized with those people that were being screwed, not only by the agribusiness people, but by Cesar Chavez himself. Cesar got his—he got picked up out of that pool hall there in Delano and taken to Chicago. And the Marxist agitator Saul Alinsky trained him and then sent him back to do a number. And he did. And I notice I haven't seen a movie about him, but I've seen some articles about him, and nobody says anything about Saul Alinsky, the kike red. Well, I guess Paula Deen has had some more problems. Uncle Bubba's Seafood and Oyster House, a restaurant owned by Paula Deen's brother, Bubba Hares, closed its doors on Thursday. Deen, a television host and celebrity chef, is part owner of the restaurant. Employees of the Savannah, Georgia restaurant showed up for work and were surprised to see the restaurant closed. The appliances were also being removed from the restaurant. There you go. The restaurant, known as in Savannah for serving fresh seafood, it is located by a marsh which provides scenic atmosphere for diners. One of its best dishes is char-grilled oysters. The restaurant also features weekly live band performances. I just wonder whether the white, I guess you'd say liberal or conservative, either one, pressure has caused them to go out of business, or whether those loyal white people, mostly Republicans that live down in that area, boycotted the restaurant. That would figure to be something that they might do, those good Christians. So, teabaggers, tell me, what's the difference between Rand Paul and all these other freaks? Kentucky GOP Senator Rand Paul is a GOP hopeful for getting nomination for 2016 U.S. president elections. And in his opinion, the future of the Republican Party depends totally and absolutely on how best they could connect with the mestizos. Yeah, we love those little brown people. This would appear to be his strategy, and in order to achieve that, he could embark on a more empathetic way of questioning the invasion reform. That appears to be one of his messages. His attention is also on the work visa system and also improving educational and employment opportunities for non-whites. Seems to me whites are having a hell of a lot of problem financing their educations, paying off these exorbitant loans and everything. But Rand Paul, the great white the great white hunter from Kentucky, he wants to do more for the mestizo. So what the hell is the difference between him and say Clinton or somebody like that? Tell me, what's the difference?
Many people in the controlled media have attacked the team.
This is not some sort of demographic coincidence. They're almost all white people, and this is, in essence, a white.
Sorry about that.
Many people in the controlled media have attacked the Tea Party movement for being so white.
It's plastic,
there is an
man.
Alarming homogeneity at the so-called Tea Party events, and that this is not some sort of demographic coincidence. In other words, they're almost all white people, and this is, in essence, a white people's party.
Oh, yeah?
But nobody in the media would attack any movement for being overwhelmingly African-American. Or for that matter, no one would condemn a pro-amnesty group for being overwhelmingly Mexican.
Yeah, you
and one thing for sure,
years.
Nobody in media would
Dave,
dare condemn
you said this
a
for
completely
years.
Jewish organization for fighting
same
for
line,
their
same
agenda.
Line.
Only when groups are identified as, quote, white, are they called racist. This is David Duke, and I want to thank you for daring to listen to the most censored person in America. Indeed, Tea Party movement supporters, those who favor less government power and more individual freedom, are overwhelmingly white and
like Rand Paul.
A strong majority of white people voted against Barack Obama and theoretically against bigger government. But even larger percentages of blacks, Mexicans, and Jews voted for Obama. Whites in Louisiana were called
we
racist
all know
because
that.
Over 65% voted
we
for
know
me
that.
To be their U.S. Senator.
Plastic
but nobody
man.
Called a 99% black vote for a black for president as racist. Now that's hypocrisy. Jewish-dominated media and Jewish financial institutions on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, also supported Obama. In fact, Goldman Sachs was his biggest corporate contributor. European-American people held the historic Tea Party in Boston, and they are the heart and soul of the modern version. A good friend of mine attended the Tea Party rally on the Mall in Washington, D.C.
Well, let me tell you something. You go to one of these Tea Party meetings and ask, are you racially conscious? Do you think that the white race should survive and expand and have more kids and control North America? And they're not going to talk to you. They might give you just a tiny bit of lip service, but they're going to ignore you and avoid you. So all this stuff about them, just because they're white, does not make them interested in really preserving the white race. Otherwise, you could ask every Tea Party member, are you a white racist? And they would say yes. Like if I was at a Tea Party meeting and they asked me if I was a white racist, of course I'm a white racist. So problem here is David Duke just keeps saying the same thing over and over like Pat Buchanan. We know all that. We've heard you say it a million times. That does not make you a white leader. A white leader is one who steps out front and really nails it to the donkey's tail to the fence and tells people straight stuff. You are not a leader. And neither is Buchanan. You say, because you say all these words, you tell people things they already know. How many times do we need to hear David Duke say the same damn thing? And he always couches it in a way that he could deny or try to deny he's a racist or try to deny he's anti-Jew. Let's pick up where we left off there. Let's see.
A million people turned out. One commentator said that Washington looked the whitest it's looked in 100 years. The usual suspects, though, are already trying to control the movement. So the self-appointed rally leaders put a whole rainbow of blacks and other races on the stage to promote an image of liberal diversity. My friend who attended said the guy next to him in the million-plus crowd said, quote, you know, they have more blacks on the stage than they have in the entire audience. The Boston Tea Party occurred in 1773. Patriots believed that no foreign power had the right to tax.
Well, anyhow, Dave, I'm going to leave you there. You still got a lot of followers out there. Yeah, we won't talk about the skeletons in the closet. But you're still playing the same old switch and bait game that you've always played. But it keeps you in groceries, I guess. But you're speaking about the Tea Party that is now pushing a man who wants to allow millions of non-white people to stay here in the United States. So what do you say about that? If you're going to talk, take the gloves off, Dave. You begin to look shop-worn. God's sake, get a haircut. Well, when I followed that trail there, I didn't realize I was going to end up with Plastic Man. That's interesting. All you people need some comedy once in a while, so I'm going to give you some comedy from, I don't know what the hell he is, Bill Maher. I guess he's a Jew, I don't know. I don't know if he's a Republican or a Democrat. But anyhow, this is a pretty funny shtick. We'll listen to it. Or go to the kitchen and get a drink.
And finally, new rule, now that the media is done freaking out about the missing jetliner,
How about going on a search for America's vanishing middle class? Now, I say this because the number of Americans who identify as middle class has never been lower. And if you don't believe me, just go shopping. The stores like Sears and Penny's that always cater to the middle market are dying. But you know who's doing great? Tiffany's and Gucci and Cartier for the Marie Antoinette crowd. And the dollar store for people who don't see a problem with Halloween candy in June. I mean, just think of how many dollar places there are now. The dollar store, Dollar Tree, Dollar General, Dollar Giant, Family Dollar, the 99 cent store, the 98 cent store. Where does it end? Just a homeless guy handing out expired toothpaste for free? But that's our economy now. You're either buying Rembrandts or Chinese cosmetics made from dirt. But in the middle, tough times. True of restaurants as well. The moderately priced ones, like Applebee's, Red Lobster, and Olive Garden, are all in trouble because they've lost their best customers, people with a little money who fill up on bread. They're the restaurants that say, "I still love you, baby, but just barely." 50 years ago, America's biggest employer was General Motors, where workers made the modern equivalent of $50 an hour. Today, America's biggest employer is Walmart, where the average wage is $8 an hour, which means you can share a room in a transient hotel with a drifter who cuts his toenails with a machete. And Walmart released their annual report this month, and in it was the fact that most of what Walmart sells is food, and most of their customers need food stamps to pay for it. Meanwhile, Walmart's owners are so absurdly rich that one of them, Alice Walton, spent over $1 billion building an art museum in Bentonville, Arkansas, 500 miles away from the nearest person who ever would want to look at art. And she said about it, "For years I've been thinking about what we could do as a family that could really make a difference. How about giving your employees a raise, you deluded nitwit?" And what we are seeing now as the income inequality increases is a lot of Americans who work hard and play by the rules starting to not play by the rules. At a McDonald's in Pittsburgh, an employee was arrested for selling heroin packed right in with the Happy Meals. And she didn't do it because she likes heroin, although it's probably no worse for you than the Filet-O-Fish. She did it because you can't raise two kids on $7.72 an hour. And for those who say she shouldn't have had two kids then, well, maybe, but she did. So what's she supposed to do now? Give them away in front of the Petco on Saturday? Or take the case of Belle Knox. She's the Duke University freshman who was recently outed as a porn star. But she doesn't have the typical porn star biography. Abused by an uncle, addicted to coke, locked in a closet by Charlie Sheen. No, she's a level-headed, articulate 18-year-old majoring in women's studies. So people are saying, why the porn? Because Duke costs $61,000 a year. Since 1980, college tuition has increased 600% above the inflation rate. I'm surprised they're not all doing porn. And even if Ms. Knox wanted to pay her way through school serving hot dogs at Wiener Schnitzel, there are no jobs at Wiener Schnitzel. So instead, she occasionally takes a wiener in the schnitzel. And this is what This is what the Paul Ryans of the world don't understand, that this is not a country of lazy people and good people, so much as it is a country of rich people and desperate people. Do you know how much Americans owe in student loans? $1.3 trillion. We're going to have to sell a lot of ass to pay that debt. Yeah, I'm afraid we're treading water and losing ground. And if you just said, hey, that's a mixed metaphor, congratulations, that's your English degree in action. Now lube up, it's time to do some porn.
There we go, with a little dark humor. A little dark humor there, how about that? Yeah, okay. I got a deal for the government. All these people are always arguing about gun control. The answer to gun control is quite simple. When the government lays down its arms, deactivates all its atomic bombs, puts all that depleted uranium ammunition, destroy it, get that all done, central government, well, I'll put down my gun. But until you put down your gun, I ain't putting down mine. Well, the State Department has no idea what happened to $6 billion used to pay its contractors. In a special management alert made public Thursday, the State Department's Inspector General, Steve Linick, warned significant financial risk and a lack of internal control of the department has led to billions of unaccounted dollars over the last 6 years. We remember that story back in the Iraq War when they had $100 million that they loaded onto a ship down there in Brooklyn, I think it was, and it got over to Iraq, and they had all that money, and they were actually taking stacks of bills and kicking them around like a football on a lot to those government people. Now, I think that was $100 billion. So anyhow, that's the way it goes. It's just paper. Might as well have fun. That shows you why the State Department should be shut down, locked up, and never let it open up again. Oh yes, there's something I'd like for you people to do for me, you wolves out there, so that I don't get mixed up here. When you send your donations to P.O. Box 401 or PayPal, it's not as important with PayPal. Send a note to merchandiseresist@yahoo.com, the webmaster, so the webmaster can help me keep track of everything so everybody gets what's coming to them. And then if you happen to, and if we've got that all down right, as long as you're within the time that we appreciate your donation, you're fine. And then if your show quits coming, well, you'll know that there's a problem there. So anyhow, if you do that for me, and make sure you put your email address on the inside of the envelope or someplace, not on the outside of the envelope, and then send a quick email to merchandise and say, hey, I just sent 20 smackaroos to that old fart back in Indiana. Give me credit, okay? Another thing you could help me with, and that's the fact that I want positive reports in the news. Not that we've marched into Washington and taken over, but I'm saying there's all kinds of ways to interpret good news. Now, the right wing dwell on bad news, and they never reconstitute it to make it good news. They never rewrite it or anything. They just send you bad news. That's not what a healthy struggle should be doing. You should be screening the internet for good news. Now, when it's bad news for the federal government and the bankers and the Zionist Jews and all those people, that's good news to us, and that's fine. But let's always put on there the this is the good news, like yesterday or day before or sometime this week, so a CIA agent allegedly jumped off the roof of the CIA building and committed suicide. Now that's good news. And that's the kind of news we like to hear. You know, when Dick Cheney swallowed a chicken bone and died gasping on the floor of a restaurant. Now that would be good news. So you got to understand and interpret good news. Good news is not always, well, I was in a fist fight and I won the fight. No. Or you can take something that looks like bad news and turn it around, rewrite it, and send it to me as good news. Because otherwise I have to reinterpret it. Sometimes even rewrite it and send it back out. So let's look for the good news. Let the right-wing conservative teabagger bastard, let them worry about the bad news. Okay? Now, if you get in the habit of that, things will go a lot better. People will be a lot more happy that are involved in the struggle. If every day they get some good news, you know? Like I just told you about the State Department losing $6 billion, that's fine. I hope they lose $100 billion, $200 billion, $1 trillion, let them lose it. When bad things happen to the system, why should we care? That's good news. We don't care about the system anymore. I hope you're still not in there caring about the system. We finally, after decades and decades and decades, finally gave up on the system. You're not going to patch it up. You're not going to vote it up. You're not going to march around the streets and get it up. Wait a minute. What am I saying? No, it's over. It's over. It's over. So rejoice. Your redemption is nigh. Don't cry when the system has a problem. You should be rejoicing when the system has a problem. Whatever's bad for the system can be good for you. It can be temporarily bad for you, but in the long run, it'll be good for you. Like the song says, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. I ain't serving your Washington. You're nothing but a whore. Sure glad Rand Paul showed his cards early on, so these, a lot of these suckers in the right wing that are racist may catch on. They may catch on. However, a lot of these people at the Tea Party, I know them like a book. I mean, I know these people like a book. They're going to make excuses for him, and they're still going to back him, but there's still going to be a lot of white people out there going to say, well, that son of a bitch, you're no better than Chuck Schumer. Well, let's listen to some more good news.
Thank you very much. I was looking at Mother Jones online today and came across a piece that they have up. I didn't know Cheney was at the Sheldon Adelson circle jerk with all these stinking Republican governors last Saturday. I didn't know. So Mother Jones says, what do former Vice President Dick Cheney and Sheldon Adelson, Republican funders and you know, real swine like that, what do they talk about? What do they applaud when they're behind closed doors at a Las Vegas hotel, aside from the strippers? Right, bombing Iran. Cheney has become, I'm trying to think of somebody else in the history of this republic who had been in the executive branch, and when he got out, turned into this psychotic devil that just keeps wanting to push the United States into war. I am not that well versed in the history of former U.S. vice presidents to come up with one, but I have lived through Cheney now. This is a sick bastard. This is a sick, sick man. He really is. And he wants everybody else to share his kind of cancer of the soul, which is exactly what he has. Anyway, as Mother Jones points out, this past weekend, this organization, Republican Jewish Coalition, which is a completely made-up Sheldon Adelson little pocket of rich Zionists, they held their leadership meeting at the Venetian Hotel. We've talked about this. Blah, 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 blah. All these guys showed up to kiss this guy's ring or his ass, one of the two, or probably both. Now, the heavy on Israel speeches of these guys were open to the press. I've shared with you what they talked about. Scott Walker saying that he now has a menorah next to his Christmas tree. Oh, whoa, really? And just crap like that, you know, just sucking up to this Zionist wanting to get his money. So the keynote address was delivered by Dick Cheney on Saturday night, and that was off limits to everybody except the billionaire Zionists and the little these little half-witted Christian Republican governors who showed up. Yep, I'm going to be president. Yep. Pick me, Sheldon. Pick me. Well. So Cheney is in there. Mother Jones obtained a recording of Cheney's talk, during which he once again derided Obama's foreign policy. I just wonder, would he ease up on Obama's foreign policy if Obama would invade countries and kill people on the level that Cheney did? Is that what this is? Cheney says, my bloodbath is bigger than your bloodbath, so you're a wimp. This is a sick man. He blasted the isolationists in the Republican Party. That would be Rand Paul. That's the only one. The rest of people in Republican parties, when somebody, you know, like Cheney steps on their foot, they open their mouths and say, give me more! Ah! But Rand Paul, for whatever he is, and he's a freak, he's in isolation. That's the only isolationist that they're talking about. Now, isolationist in the first place is a term from, I don't know what, the 30s? Why Cheney's using it, I guess he uses it because Adelson is old enough to have remembered the 30s, and so many of these Zionist donors, yeah, they were around in the 30s. So isolationist, ooh, what an old word. How do you be an isolationist in the wired and webbed up 21st century? Who, how, where? But they'll use the term anyway. Cheney will. Because he knows it'll get inside the heads of these guys like a tapeworm and just kind of work its way around the brain cells. You know, Cheney's good at that. He just that monotonic kind of. I just every time I see him talk, I expect to see at some point a little bitty hand come reaching up out of his mouth and hear this voice say, "Save me, save me." I mean, that's how weird this guy is. He also endorsed the idea that Israel should start bombing Iran yesterday. Okay, tomorrow. All right, today, last week, whenever, get it done. Speaking about the possibility of Iran developing a nuclear weapon, Cheney dismissed Obama's negotiations with Iran. And he recalled a dinner meeting he had in 2007 with Israeli General Amos Yadlin. Yadlin had flown in the Israeli Defense Forces mission in 1981 that destroyed Iraq's Osirak nuclear reactor. And General Amos Yadlin was Israel's foremost military intelligence chief when the Israel Defense Forces obliterated Syria's nuclear reactor in the Deir el-Zor region. Recalling his conversation with this guy, Cheney said, he looked across the table for dinner and he said, two down, one to go. I knew exactly what he meant. Oh, did you? Well, Dick, that's because you're so goddamn wise and far-seeing and almost preternaturally intelligent. You know, it's just unbelievable. So when Cheney told that one-to-go story, According to the recording that Mother Jones had, the crowd responded approvingly with laughter and applause. Now, if you remember last October when Adelson said that this publicly, that the U.S. should drop a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert. Just go drop one to show Tehran what will happen if, I don't know, the leadership of Iran didn't immediately rip off its rose and present its rear ends for Adelson to inspect. I don't know. But drop a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert to show Tehran what will happen to Iran if it develops nuclear weapons. Adelson. How many, remember when Stalin said, how many divisions does the Pope control? How many nuclear bombs does Adelson control? Well, how many does Israel have? I'm sure that Sheldon Adelson has something to say about how, when, and where those bombs will be used. Don't you think? At least he seems to think so. So it doesn't matter what you or I think. It's what Shelley thinks. So, according to Mother Jones, during this behind-closed-doors talk, Cheney took multiple shots at Obama. He said Obama has been a bust at home and abroad. He said Obama has been a weak commander-in-chief. He said that Obama has failed to project strength around the world. He said, this is a direct quote, "The bottom line is," Cheney groused, "the United States' position in the Middle East is worse than any time in my lifetime." Which lifetime, Dick? You've been around for thousands of years, you know. He added, "It's reached the point where Israel and Egypt, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Jordan are closer to one another," imagine that, "than any of them is to us." Could that possibly be, I don't know, let me just stretch here. Could that possibly be because of the 8 years of corrupt, murderous foreign policy that you and your puppet, George Bush, put out there for the rest of the world to consume? You think? Maybe? Cheney? You ghoul?
Under my control, I don't need security. I got a Colt 45 in here with me. I'll scare off intruders in my fatigue, black jacket, and army boots.
Now, don't you see the good news there? I sure see it. We got the sleaziest kike in the country is fleecing the working people of all their money, even though they're to blame too. That controls billions of dollars and controlled the last election, I guess, with that miserable candidate they put up, and probably had to do with the miserable candidate before that, McCain. I mean, can you believe those guys? And you got him meeting with all these governors and all these people want to be president of the United States, and they're all kissing his ass. Nothing is more illustrative to the average person than seeing a white, conservative, Republican, Christian getting down on their knees kissing the ass of a ugly, fat, greasy Jew. That's good news for me. That's my kind of good news. You remember I was talking to you about that little worm that's evolved into eating up all the corn and eating up the poison too. Well, let's listen to a little bit of this. This is more good news if you look at it in the right way, because most of this corn is being overplanted all over the United States and really big time here in Indiana. It's not going to feed the American people. It's going overseas. Or making corn-based food and so forth that's not good for you. And corn syrup and all that kind of stuff is very bad for you.
Producing states in this country, heavily Christianized. We were talking yesterday about Wyoming. I don't know. They grow corn in Wyoming? I don't know. I'm talking about how Wyoming now is going to deny textbooks or teaching methods that include explanations and definitions of global warming. How do these religious school boards handle, or even the teachers handle, with their elementary students in Iowa or Missouri or Kansas, you know, all the corn-producing states? How do you explain to them this little worm? And the fact that it, here it comes again, evolved. Seriously. And I think the answer, and I'm asking that sincerely, I usually just mock religion because I think it's such a hoax, such a horror that's been perpetrated on the human race. But that's a legitimate question. That's not mocking. I guess what the teachers will do is just not talk about it. They'll say, oh, well, the corn got poisoned or something. I don't know. But if they were truthful, if they operated within a truthful system, wouldn't they have to tell the school children whose parents might be farmers, might be corn farmers, and all of a sudden dad comes in to dinner one night and says, we're bankrupt, we're going to lose the farm? Why? Because of the worm. But we had stuff to kill the worm, Dad. Yeah, but the worm turned. It was a magic worm. How do you do that? How do you explain to the children there's no such thing as evolution, but it's evolution that has destroyed the corn crop? How do you do that? That's amazing stuff. This shows you the real power of religion, the power to totally screw your mind up where you cannot look at something black and say it's black, or something white and say it's white. If the Bible says, no, both of those are maroon. BT corn, for those of you keeping track, the genetically modified corn was first introduced in the market in 1996. So it has taken, 18 years for this evolution to occur? Probably less. I mean, it didn't just start yesterday. These BT corn-eating worms, they didn't just develop yesterday. I don't know when the evolution began. Probably the first time one of these worms bit into corn that had been genetically modified to poison it. And in that moment, the worm went, oh, damn, this doesn't taste right. You tried to kill me again? In order to keep these worms from developing a resistance to the BT corn toxin, in other words, evolving, farmers were told to keep refuges of non-BT corn so that rootworms could grow there unaffected. They're trying to trick the worm. Hey, over here! Here! Susan, I got an acre of corn over here. Come and eat this. Leave my 300 acres alone.
What?
Come over here. Trying to trick a worm whose genetic structure is probably so ancient. Oh, well, it's worth a try, right? Right? Farmers were told to keep refuges of regular corn so the rootworms could grow there unaffected. And those worms, the ones who were supposed to go, here, over here in this corn, they were meant to have sex with worms in the fields where the poison was in order to keep the worms from developing an immunity to the GMO corn. They had it all figured out, didn't they, huh? Well, over here, we'll have non-genetically modified corn, and the worms will be happy. And when they want to get laid, maybe they'll go visit the worms in the BT corn thing or vice versa. And then they'll go ahead and do whatever sex they do. And the new ones will be born without or with, the BT resistant, whatever the hell it is. But it didn't work. Smart-ass worms, huh? Not only did they go ahead and eat up the refuge corn, so-called, not only did they go ahead and have as much sex as they wanted, hey, look at this, we get all this free sex and all this free corn, and none of it's poison. Damn! Not only did all that happen, but the ability of these evolved or mutated worms to now devour the genetically modified corn has increased to the point where, whoops, they're in Illinois, Minnesota, Nebraska, South Dakota, You know, some days everything just goes straight into the crapper. You ever notice that?
Well, there we go. The cornworm's happy. He's doing fine. He's eating the insecticide that Monsanto put out as delicious food. Not bothering him because he's evolved and developed a resistance to Monsanto. Like you should. We should all form a resistance to Monsanto Corporation and eliminate it from the face of the earth. The company that brought you Agent Orange and killed who knows how many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people in Vietnam, plus all our soldiers that got died from Agent Orange. Yeah, that's with the chemicals that keep on giving. Yeah. Well, is it good news or not? Well, if you look at it from if you don't listen, you'll have to feel, I guess it is good news, even though it's initially bad. But maybe you have to have some real bad news to where you might straighten up and fly right. Like they used to say, I got goosed and then I walked straight. You know, I've promoted this book, Might is Right, for quite a while, and I really love the book. However, it's pretty extreme, and there's parts of it that I think that you can get a little excited about, but you better take a little bit with a tongue-in-cheek. But anyhow, most of it's good for you, and so we're going to close out the show today, and I'm going to read a little bit from it here, if I can find my spot. I think this must be talking about now, even though it was written a long time ago. The citadel of power is now consolidated and prepared with the most improved armaments to repel and assault. No matter how well sustained, the nation is intersected in all directions with iron high roads and splendid waterways, whereon the armies and the navies may be moved from city to city, from facility with dread effect. The war of secession, or rather the war for annihilation of self-government, demonstrated conclusively that a centralized authority resting on herd votes of the vulgar and fanatic, in practice, military absolutism, there's no other power in the land that can effectively hold it in check unless it deteriorates on its own power due to greed and all the things that go with it. The Tsar of Russia possesses less actual authority than our federal government. And that was back when the Tsar had a lot of power, man. With a standing army in the hollow of its hand, it can do exactly as it pleases, i.e., if it can collect enough revenue or steal enough money from the people to purchase statesmen, congressmen, and senators, and pay the salaries, the payoffs of its Praetorian cohorts, the professional army. Most Americans are only now beginning to perceive these things, but they were foreseen and also foretold in part by clear-sighted individuals before the Constitution itself was formally enthroned. Today, the old Sphinx questions are up again for solution. No man of balanced sense can honestly believe that these problems are to be settled by ballot box stuffing or editorialism. Settling they must upon the good old rule, the simple plan, and therefore settled and resettled again and again. For there is no finality in social adjustments, and there should not be. Material strength is the basis of all human greatness, and material strength must settle the tyranny of the greatest number, probably with fire and steel. All other theories are chimeras, lies, and delusions, make-believe, and no account. The philosophy of power has slumbered long, but whenever men of sterling worth are found, it must again sweep away the ignoble, dollar-damned peddlerisms of today and openly as of old. Dominate the destiny of an emancipated and all-conquering race. What is viler than a government of slaves and usurious Jews? What is grander than a government of the noblest and the best who have proved their fitness on the plains of death? Cromwell and his Ironside, Caesar and his legions shall be born again, and the thunderous tread of Sulla's fierce destroyers shall roll and rumble amid the fire and the glare and smoke of crumbling constitutionalisms, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, warfare without end. Yapping politicians may harangue base city mobs of hirelings and Christlings with, alas, poor Yorick, rhapsody, as if struggle and strife were the evil of all evils. Figures of speech, however, cannot breathe the breath of life into feline philosophies that never have had the slightest foundation in fact. The survival of the fittest, the toughest, is the logic of events and of all time. They who declare otherwise are blind. The chief point is this, that fitness must honestly demonstrate itself, not by ignoble theft in theory, but by open conflict, as per Darwin's law of battle. How can citizens be honestly described as free and equal who are not, who never were free and equal, in any reasonable sense of the phrase? How can they be even considered men whose whole lives are governed by cast iron regulations, whose every movement circumscribed and restrained by penal threats, even whose secret thoughts are in a constant state of silent repression? It is no apology whatever to affirm that people themselves enact all laws they are commanded to obey, even that statesmen is a falsity if it were true. It would not justify majority dictatorship or any other kind of dictatorship. The Constitution under which all laws are born was accepted, not by us, but by bewigged individuals who are long since rotten. We are ruled, in fact, by cadavers, the inhabitants of tombs. And isn't that true? Think of all the laws that have been passed down through the 20th century and now into the 21st. And how many of them, most of those people who passed them are dead, but these laws still rule over us, and we allow it? Why should agreements made by confined dead men bind and mortgage living, pulsing, breathing beings? Their bones have long ago moldered into the ozone and fertilizers. Who drew up and signed the Bill of Rights, Magna Carta, Sermon on the Mount, Declaration of Independence, our glorious Constitution, and so on and so on? Rotten are the brains that concocted them and the fingers that signed and sealed them. Equally rotten are their irrational and infantile philosophies. Rotten also in their heart are the men who obey under compulsion voices from the tomb. Quit obeying voices from the tomb, boys and girls. No doubt those old documents served their purpose at the time, but new occasions teach new duties, and new ages require not only new leaders, but new deeds. Again, most acts of Congress are Machiavellian work of eminent rogues. Curse them with their very names are almost forgotten, except by partisan chronicles and printers of public school histories. You know, on the weekend we get the book review on on our cable, on C-SPAN, and it's endless drudgery about the wonderful General Grant, the wonderful general, the wonderful generals of the past, the generals of the First World War, the Second World War, all these great people, all these great high people. They live in the past. You can't live in the past. Now is the time to live. As for the common law, it's an inheritance from those interesting old days when Saxon and Norman earls, they were genuine noblemen then, for they had won their position by risking their lives in battle, fighting their own battles, administered justice direct per media of knotted clubs, hilted knives, and long-handled cleavers. They were right on the front lines with their people. That was the only kind of law understood by our uncivilized forefathers, for they had not been educated into the profound conviction that government and laws derive all their just powers from the consent of the government. What a joke. Such an expression would have sent them into convulsions, and he who uttered it would be considered a most excellent fool. And I hear that foolish talk all the time. If you don't vote, you shouldn't gripe. You can't criticize if you don't vote. Well, the fact that I don't vote is the main meaning of being against the government and disagreeing with everything they stand for is why I don't vote. That is a positive vote, not voting. No doubt our ancestors were... See, if you vote, in other words, you are endorsing the process. You're endorsing the process. That's all they want you to do. You're not going to tell them what to do. You're going to vote for them, and then they're going to do what they want to do. But you're simply endorsing them to do whatever they want to you. I wrote a long letter to my senator, and that's all you get back is form letters. You know what would be the best way for people to operate is to climb up on his desk and grab him by the throat. But those times are not yet. Those times are not yet. They should be, but they're not. No doubt our ancestors were somewhat rude in their manners, somewhat deficient in sweetness and culture, but in matters of frozen fact, they were decidedly logical. And that's the word you always should remember in politics, in everything. Be logical. They did not sneak to public meetings and swagger about liberty, justice, and equality of opportunity, or the rights of men and the niggas and the Mexicans and everybody else, the invaders, when they knew full well that not only their lives, but everything they nominally possessed was by leave of their conquerors and proprietors, our slave masters. They don't, these congressmen and senators don't treat you like people. Oh, they'll lie to you and pat you on the back and say, you're a good little boy, while my congressman gets over $1 million every year not to plant corn. And then he gripes about poor people who don't have jobs and they can't get any help, and they don't have any food stamps and the whole bit. But the same son of a bitch is robbing the people many times over. The senators and the governor, they're all that way. But everything they nominally possessed was by leave of their conquerors and proprietors. They accept their position pro tem, and when again ready, honestly, re-enter the doom ring to test anew their fate. And that's the election time. Let me see here. If they could come alive again, how those old pirates and freebooters would stare in shame and scorn at the sight of their tenderfoot posterity, walking up in solemn, horny-handed, humpback procession in shoddy rags before the idolater altar called a ballot box, dropping into its gilded maw printed invocations for justice, mercy, liberty, peace in our time, O Lord. Protection. Cheap money. More laws, more laws, more laws. How our blonde, clean-limbed ancestors would guffaw. Indeed, they would probably keep on guffawing until they guffawed themselves to death again. Oh, they would say, to think that our seed should have sank so low. And that's the end of my reading from Might is Right for today. And that is the end of the show for Saturday. And we'll be back with you on Moon's Day. We'll give you a break tomorrow to catch up on the shows and to rest your ears. 14:05.
Big John. Big John.
Every morning at the mine you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Nobody seemed to know where John called home. He just drifted into town and stayed all alone. He didn't say much, he was kind of quiet and shy. And if you spoke at all, you just said hi to Big John. Somebody said he came from New Orleans, where he got in a fight over a Cajun queen, and a crashing blow from a huge right hand sent a Louisiana fella to the promised land, Big John.
Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Then came the day at the bottom of the mine when a timber cracked and men started crying. Miners were praying and hearts beat fast, and everybody thought that they'd breathed their last except John. Through the dust and the smoke of this man-made hell walked a giant of a man that the miners knew well, grabbed a sagging timber and gave out with a groan, and like a giant oak tree just stood there alone, Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
And with all of his strength, he gave a mighty shove. Then a miner yelled out, "There's a light up above." And 20 men scrambled from a would-be grave. Now there's only one left down there to save, Big John. With Jackson timbers, they started back down. Then came that rumble way down in the ground. And as smoke and gas belched out of that mine, everybody knew it was the end of the line for Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Now they never reopened that worthless pit. They just placed a marble stand in front of it. These few words are written on that stand. At the bottom of this mine lies a big, big man. Big John.
Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John. Big John.
Don't forget, there's more to Might is Right than just big armies, big guns, and a desire just to conquer. It takes a lot of other things that go along with it. And in fact, those things should be used first before the latter. There's been people in this last 20th century have had tremendously large armies and all kinds of great plans and all kinds of big weapons, but they lost. So there was some faulty logic going on there on all sides.